Welcome back, everybody. It's good to have you with us here on The Mark Steiner Show. We are about to have a conversation on this day of the inauguration of Donald J. Trump as President of the United States, which is taking place as we speak here on The Mark Steiner Show. We're going to talk about what that means for now in the future. We're going to reflect a bit on the 8 years of Barack Obama, the arc between Obama and Trump, from a bunch of different perspectives. Joining us by phone is Sarah Van Gelder, who is executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Adam Jackson's in the studio. He's CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. Good to have you in the studio, Adam.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Carsonia K. Whitehead's in the studio as well. She's Associate Professor of Communication and African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, author of Race Brave, New and Selected Works, Notes from a Color Girl, and the Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis and My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Kay, good to have you back in the house
as
well.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
Adar Ayira is here as well. Adar is the project manager for More in the Middle campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. And Adar, always good to have you in the house.
Thank you for having me.
So let's just begin. I mean, so here we have, let me just ask you all how you feel on this very day. Let me start there. Then we can kind of talk about what these last 8 years have meant and where they might be going. So tell me your viscerally, intellectually, politically, what you feel at this moment that Donald Trump is being sworn in as the 45th president of the United States of America. Adar?
So I feel that today is a day of white lash. The resistance against the presidency and legacy of President Barack Obama.
It's been a very long week. It's been a long last couple of months. I think I'm
Kay Whitehead, by the way.
Yes. So I am both sad. This idea of this neat transition of power that's taking place. But I'm also very excited because people are rising up and are willing to resist, are willing to stand up, are willing to make their voices heard. They're not being complacent as they watch what is happening in Washington, D.C. Few things are very clear. Donald J. Trump is our 45th president, and we need to think about what that means individually and collectively.
Sarah Van Gelder.
Yeah, I mean, it feels like a sucker punch in the gut, quite honestly. I just never thought we'd see somebody quite so illegitimate, as to quote John Lewis, taking the power in the United States. And I agree with what Kay said. I think that there is a silver lining in the sense of people rising up, in the sense of Democratic members of Congress who are boycotting the inauguration today. 60 is the last count I saw. And in terms of people coming together and saying, you know, this isn't the kind of country we are, and we're going to be something different.
Adam Jackson.
I feel exactly the same as I felt yesterday. America has elected its most appropriate leader. You know, mm-hmm. Donald Trump is representative of what America stands for, its legacy. And we might as well elect a leader that represents America's real ideals, which is one of sexism, homophobia, racism, and white supremacy. And I don't think that we should be, I guess I never had any faith in this country to begin with. So being frustrated at the democratic process, it's like, no, that's exactly what America's designed to do in the first place. And the hood is going to look the same after Trump is president. It looks mm-hmm. the same now when Barack Obama was president. It looked the same before when Bush was president, and so on and so forth. So I feel exactly the same.
Okay. I'll preserve my feelings as we go through the conversation. I mean, this is a very strange time that we're in, I think. And I think a little bit of what everybody said, I think, from my perspective, is real, and I think it's a complex situation. I think it's about race. I think it's also about economic nationalism and people being terrified of their jobs and what's happening to their jobs in this country. That's intertwined with race, but not exclusively about race. I think that it's we've seen the real divide in this country. You know, different perspectives on who we are as a people and what that means. And where we take it is the question. You're about to say what, Kay?
Well, I think it's interesting that we have very young people who are engaged in these conversations as well. I've just come back from a week of traveling around the country and talking to 6, 7, and 8-year-olds about what's happening in Washington in ways that, and I'm not sure if I would have heard that. I used to be a middle school teacher and back during another time, and they would talk about Washington, but not in the same way that a 6-year-old is saying today, oh, you know, President Trump, he did this, and President Trump, I don't like him because of this. I mean, these are 6 and 7 and 8-year-olds who are engaging in these discussions. I'm very hopeful about that, because if we can have them at that early age begin to really think about what's taking place in Washington, beginning to help them have a more critical eye, it's really helping them in terms of being better citizens to think about their vote when it is time to vote. So that's what I mean about silver lining. It's not that I am happy about what's taking place. Maybe I've just become resigned about what's taking place, and it's made me more committed to be involved in making sure change takes place, like Adam said, on the very real and local level. And I wonder if he's a little bit excited about that. I think people are actually more focused on local politics now than maybe they weren't under Barack Obama. They look towards kind of this holy figure on the hill to keep their lights on and to get, you know, groceries on their block in a way they're not doing now. They're really thinking about local politics in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would have said the same thing back when Barack Obama was elected president, because when I was a sophomore in college when Barack Obama was elected, and I was happy for like 15 minutes until I saw all the white people running into the streets saying, yeah, we have a black president now, racism is over. And so back then I was hopeful, because my hope was that black people in my age group would be more excited about, you know, local politics and things like that. But Barack Obama inoculated them and made them go to sleep for 8 years. And now we're watching all these viral videos of how great his wife is and how great his children are and how great Barack Obama was as a president. And so to me, it's a cyclical thing. So to me, Donald Trump's presidency should represent a complete loss of faith in the idea that we should just sit around, not be involved, not be active, and not build grassroots power. And so I'm excited about students thinking about that and young people thinking about that. I think the question is now, are we just going to do what we've been doing and invest back in the Democratic Party and back into the infrastructure that brought us here, or are we actually going to organize for real radical political change?
I know across the country, Sarah, we'll be talking about next month when you're in town with your new book, that you've been doing just that. You've been across the country looking at what people are doing at the grassroots all across America.
That's right. And I think that that is where our hope is now. I think, for starters, that's where the most effective resistance can be, because we know that the federal government's going to be on the wrong side of just about everything. And so we clearly need to get organized, and people are showing up. That's what I keep hearing. People are showing up in large numbers in their communities and saying, you know, what can we do? How can we join forces? And it's also where we can resist some of the hate crimes that I think we're likely to see rolling out at an even greater level because of the kind of ethos that Trump and his followers have unleashed. So I think it's a really important time for us to be reaching out to one another. That's happening in my community. We're reaching out especially to the immigrant community and to the folks at the local mosque, and we're just starting to say to each other, you know, we have to be there for each other. We can't take for granted that anybody's safe right now. We have to be there for each other. And from that point of view, from that starting point, we can not only get to know each other and get to work better together, but we can also start figuring out how to build power so that we can make good things happen in our community and resist the awfulness that will be coming down from the federal government.
So, you know, it's always interesting to me, Mark, when we talk about Trump as if this is somehow unleashing something that has never happened before, when the reality is that the election of President Barack Obama twice was the anomaly in American history. And so now we're saying, oh, you know, even though race and class are intertwined, it really is about class. Well, you know, what it is about is the loss of privilege, the loss of the currency of the privilege of whiteness. And that is not negating any of the other reasons, but it is saying that if it were only about class, there are so many outcomes in terms of health, in terms of wealth, in terms of other social indicators that for African Americans have stayed pretty consistent for the last 50 years. It is only when the whiteness currency in terms of jobs, in terms of how children can rise to the middle class and stay in the middle class, when those things were impacted for white America, that we started talking about class and the middle class. And we always talk about it now in terms of whiteness. We don't say it that way, but when we're talking about the breadbasket, when we use a lot of code words for white America, and we really need to just stop with the code words and really talk about what it is that we are really talking about, which is a loss of class privilege and whiteness currency.
If I could just add to that, I've been thinking a lot this week going into this period about Dr. King's speech, staying awake through the Great Revolution, this notion that we have to force ourselves to remain awake because it's easy to go to sleep. And the way I think about that and define it is that it's easy to become used to things, that we put up this big fight when we pushed to get Barack Obama elected. People got used to it. People didn't see it as an anomaly, like you just said. They got used to it. Oh, there's a black man in the White House. It's a part of who we are. And they became very comfortable. And then in many ways, they went to sleep. The fight that happened on the streets that was being pushed by the millennials with Black Lives Matter, for a number of people who were much older, you know, middle class, a little bit older, this idea of Black Lives Matter was something that did not connect with them and didn't resonate with them in any real substantial ways of, I must get out here and I must also be willing to put my body on the line to help in this struggle. Oh, no, this is about the young people, because we've made it. We have a black man in the White House. And even going through this election with the election and of Donald Trump, people all of a sudden woke up and said, what has happened? Are we back racist again? We're no longer post-racial, as if they've been asleep for the last 8 years. You had a black man in the White House, and I think in terms of images, I think that's important. Ta-Nehisi Coates makes the argument that images are important, seeing a black man in the White House. But what changed on the ground? At the same time, you had this through line of Barack Obama. You also had this through line of the beginning of the movement for black lives that happened under his presidency. So people who are saying, I don't know what happened. I'm not sure how this happened. Who was in charge of this? What did we do wrong? I'm like, where have you been for 8 years? How did you get to a point where you thought, with just the election of this one person, if you look at how Congress remained white, you look at how the Supreme Court is still white. I don't know how you thought this one man was going to, what, you know, raise the dead and walk on water. There were so many expectations on him. He could not even have begun to do everything they expected one person to do, which is dismantle hundreds of years of systemic racism.
You know, and I think that when you ask black people, were they surprised that Trump won? So many of them say no. When you ask white people, were they surprised Trump won? So many of them say yes. So
the ones who voted for him.
So I think that there is also that disconnect, and in terms of where we are situationally placed by race, by class, by a lot of other host of issues, that dictates who was surprised and who is not based on their lived experience in America, even within a Barack Obama presidency.
Right. I mean, I guess I would push back a little thing. I think a lot of people were surprised, no matter who they were in this country. And that's what all the polls tell us as well. People were not expecting this, but I think we should have expected it, given the analysis of where we've come from and what this was about and who did not vote and why the people didn't vote and where that stood. I think the legacy of Barack Obama is complex, which is what I want to tackle when we come back from break here, just talk a bit about who Barack Obama was. The image that you talked about, Kay, and the image that Ta-Nehisi and other people have written about, I think that's clearly important and powerful. And also, it's interesting to look at this group of Congress people who are not going to the inauguration today, 60-plus people, that are a good portion of the Black Congressional Caucus, a good portion of the Progressive Caucus, white, black, Asian, Latino, not going to this caucus, and the people they represent in not going to this caucus. I think it's huge. And so what does that mean? What does it take us? We're going to explore that and who Barack Obama was these last 8 years and the complexity of his presidency. We talked about a little bit on the show earlier this week in one of our panels, and we're going to kind of get into that and also talk about what we're going to do, what we think we should do post this election, which we talked about actually Wednesday on the Steiner Show with Lester Spence and Arun Gupta. But we'll tackle that and more. So stay with us. We'll be right back with our four guests, Dr. Kay Whitehead, Adara Ayira, Adam Jackson, Sarah Van Gelder, and talking on this day of this inauguration, just what is happening. We'll be back. Welcome back, folks. We're here on this inauguration day. Every time I say that, it's a little weird, but
get used to it.
I think we do have to get used to it.
We do.
And used to it, knowing that it is there. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah. Right.
And that's, of course, the voice of Dr. Garsonia K. Whitehead, who's Associate Professor of Communications and African American Studies at Loyola University, a noted author. Adar Ayira is in the studio, project manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities, facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, and Sarah Van Gelder, executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine. And so picking up on the theme, let's just, before we come back into discussion, which I do want to get into about Trump and who voted for him, who didn't, why he's there, why he's not, and what that was. I think it's more complex than we think when you look at some of the stats of actually who voted for him. But having said that, we've just come off of 8 years of Barack Obama, the first African-American president of the United States. And it's a very complex, let me throw something out here and y'all can just leap on me and disagree with me and say what you got to say, which I'm really looking forward to. So, you know, let me say a little story. So the first time in 2008, I was covering the election, covering the in Denver. I was actually sending out instantaneous stuff at the DNC from the convention. And I remember sitting there with the Maryland delegation, the Hawaii delegation was to my right, and Michelle Obama came to the stage. And then I looked up in the stage, and I was just kind of overwhelmed by this idea that this woman I'm looking at could become First Lady of the United States of America, given the history of this country. And that kind of really shell-shocked me. And I thought about that because in 1964, when I was a lad of 18, I was standing in Atlantic City with Fannie Lou Hamer and remembering that moment with that woman and what that meant, right? And then watching them up there, and when the whole family got up there, this woman was standing next to me who was a delegate from Prince George's County, her husband, who was Guyanese, and I were sitting next to each other. And we looked at each other and realized that we weren't sobbing and crying, but tears were just pouring down our face. All three of us, just because of just what the overwhelming nature of this moment. And then 4 years later, I had all these kind of questions about some of the stuff, especially Barack Obama did in the beginning of his presidency, which I did not agree with, thought he did not go far enough on lots of stuff. But I still, and then watching all his racist assault on him, and said, well, there's no way, no matter what I disagree with the moment, I'm letting anybody push this black family out of the White House. It's not going to happen. You know, so those emotions were very raw and real, and I watched the emotions of the image of the family in that we have in our news, and the power of that image is huge. It's almost, in some senses, in a visceral sense, in a sense of people's emotions in this country, almost more powerful than what he has done or has not done, just in terms of, you know, the effect that had in society. So it's a very mixed legacy for me about Barack Obama. And very mixed feelings about at this moment. You know, it's not so easy to kind of put into a simple place, at least for me. So,
well, I've been wrestling with that as well.
Kate Whitehead.
As I was riding over with my son, I mean, I was remembering, you know, my own stories that in 2013, when Asala and the White House called me to be one of only four historians to speak at the White House's Black History Month panel. And I know when I hung the phone up, I did start crying. I'm thinking, wow, there's a black man in the White House, and I'm actually going to the White House to speak. I mean, I pulled my sons out of school. My husband came out of school. My parents came with me. And that was in 2013. When they called me again in 2014, it was that same feeling, like, wow, they've called me back again, that they have 100,000 historians. I'm one of four. And then when I was back again in 2015, I kept saying, well, now, every time I've gone to this Black History Month panel, I've spoken, and he hasn't been there. Will I ever have a chance? Just because I wanted to see him. And when I finally, just this past February in 2016, had a chance to go to his last Black History Month reception, and I can only take one person. And I told my husband, the only person I want to take, as much as I love my husband, I want to take my father, because I remember how my father cried. I mean, people can say whatever they want. I remember when he cried both times that Barack Obama got, because he said, I just never thought growing up in the Jim Crow South that we would have this moment. And we had a chance to meet him. I took pictures with him. And I know we can talk about and critique him every day. And I definitely enjoy doing that. But I know personally, that moment for me to actually meet him and take a picture and say, wow, he made history despite all the odds and things that we've been working for as a people for a long time. He didn't achieve everything. But the fact that you are here that did speak to me. So, yes, I want to critique him, but in the midst of critiquing, I want to say that there is an image I hold very dear, knowing that for the past 8 years, at least for my sons, the president they've grown up with is a president who looks like them. So now we can talk about policy, but I think there's something about this image piece that we should not overlook.
Right. That's why I began that for a reason.
Yeah.
We're going to get into policy pretty deeply, but I got this sort of there for a reason. Yeah. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I guess
Adam Jackson.
To me, the question of the imagery of Barack Obama being president, to me, has just never been enough. Because even as a young person that grew up in, I grew up in a Bush era Bush era presidency, and I just remember like, yeah, this is exactly how America is. It's white. It's invested in geopolitical white supremacy. Like this is the country that I have come to know. This is historically what this country has been. And so when I'm talking about. Well, when I saw Barack Obama elected as president, I had almost no feeling. I was like, yeah, this is going to be 8 more years of people telling me that race is over, 8 more years of people not organizing for power, 8 more years of people acting like that the issues that have led us up to this point don't exist. And I also remember how angry black people were before Barack Obama became the front runner for the Democratic Party. I remember people talking about organizing for power and as a young person. And so to see him kind of ascend, to me, is like acting like he overcame. He didn't overcame. He was presented to us by white folks to make sure that we weren't organizing for powers while he was president. And so in terms of the imagery piece, I mean, it's nice to have black boys and black girls see an image of themselves in a high position of power, but at the same time, it gives them a false sense of hope in this country that you can overcome and change racism because you became president. Because even the fact that we've been talking about his legacy, to me, illustrates the fact that no matter how far you rise, you cannot rise above the collective conditions of your people. So if you're black and you become president, you can't rise above the fact that your people are being killed by police every day and that a movement spurred under your presidency and that the Black Lives Matter movement only exists because we have access to more media to be able to show how we've been brutalized by police. And so the fact that it even became to prominence while we had a black president and that it still proliferates at the same levels, to me, is an example of systemic racism and white supremacy. So his image is nice to me, and it's nice to my children to be able to tell them, look how great his wife is and how great his daughters are. But at the same time, if the collective conditions of black people have not changed, it doesn't matter who's in the office. So to me, the imagery piece isn't as profound, especially considering I grew up. I mean, I didn't vote for him in 2008. I voted for Cynthia McKinney and Rosa Clemente because I didn't believe in that hope he was talking about, because the hope he promised didn't get delivered. So in my mind, the image that I was sold was false, and that the fact that we had Donald Trump as president furthers my belief that this is the kind of country I live in.
The truth has been, one of the first times I ever did not vote third party.
We're all confessing today.
So I want to, you know, I kind of feel like I am in the Valley of Oz. And I just want to say, let's just take a peek behind that curtain, right? Because here's the thing. The optics were great. It was great that he won. But let's go a little deeper and examine why he won and examine his campaign. Especially in 2008, Barack Obama won on presenting himself as someone who did not come through, whose historical roots were not in the Ma'afa. Right, who did not grow up being a part of a civil rights era of trying to fight racism, white supremacy. He grew up with his family history. He had a white grandmother, grandfather, parents, a white mother, and for white people. And you can go back and look at the interviews that were done. People were saying, well, he's not scary. He's only half black. He's this. He's that. And then when he did his speech, there's no white, there's no red America. There's no blue America. Mm-hmm. Everything that he did was presented to almost work against the fact that his name was Barack Hussein Obama and that he was a black man. So let's not forget that. Let's not forget where the country was economically. Let's not forget those things that went into his victory. And if we look behind that curtain, and if we do a deeper dive into this, then we can really have some information that balances out this optic that we want to present and that was really sold to us as being one of a post-racial United States of America. Because if you look at how he was elected, look at what his campaign narrative was, you see reasons that he did win despite being a black man in America. And for the reason that he was not a Jesse Jackson or Al Sharpton or the black boogeyman that are always set up as being the black face of America.
Before I jump in here, Sarah Vangoda, please jump in.
Yeah, I think I agree with everything that's been said, and I think there was another thing to look at, which is what happened immediately after he took office, when Dick Cheney and the other Republicans just started coming at him, and coming at him in a way that had a clear racial tinge to it. Donald Trump was among them, talking about this birther question. Yes. I mean, I can't imagine this kind of criticism and this kind of hate being directed at a white man who had taken office. There was something about the permission that these Republicans felt to attack him that certainly had a racial tinge to it. And, you know, I think he navigated an incredibly thorny set of issues in some ways that I wish he had done differently. I think he could have stepped up in ways that were more radical. I think he was trying to somehow chart a course down the middle, and by doing that, for example, on the way that his healthcare initiative rolled out. I think he was trying to keep the insurance companies placated to make sure that they could still make their big profits and the drug companies could keep on making super profits by charging whatever they wanted. So he was trying to placate folks like that, and as a result, actually advocated for policy that is really problematic. It's not nearly as strong as something like the a single-payer system would be. So he kind of set himself up. I'm not sure he had a lot of choices given how much he was under attack, but I do think that there are ways in which not coming forth with policies like the kind that Bernie Sanders was putting forth, not doing that in a kind of a compromising, trying to placate the right, trying to placate the racists and the Republicans, that by doing that he actually fell short of what his legacy could have been.
So let me kind of parse some of this stuff out that we've all said here. And I'm going to come to what you were saying, Sarah, I was thinking a lot about. I'm going to come to that in just a few minutes so we can get into that before you have to jump off. Because I think it's important to examine his early part of his 2008 to 2010 and what that was about. But very quickly, I mean, just coming back, I mean, I think that, you know, in some ways, Adar, I think that it's shortchanging some of the people who actually voted for Obama who were not black. If you look at what most people said, and what most studies have shown, that the 30% of folks who are white who voted for Barack Obama didn't do it because his mother was white. They voted for him because, for the first time, I think, in American history, and you and I have gone about this before, mm-hmm. the first time in American history, there is a quarter to a third, whatever that number is, let's say it's a quarter for argument's sake, all right, of white folks in America who think racism is a problem and has to be dealt with. And I think part of what elected Barack Obama, even with folks who weren't there completely, that 5 to 7% of voters who voted for Barack Obama who now voted for Trump, which is that they think they assume around 5%, they're not sure, but 7% maybe. But at any rate, that group of people, people were moved, I think, because I think racism is so deeply embedded in the marrow of this society. You don't even know you're being motivated by stuff when it comes to race in America, whether mm-hmm. you're black or white or Native American mm-hmm. or Mexican American or Puerto Rican, whoever you are. And that I think that given the history of this country, people saw the embodiment of the future in a black man, given the oppressive nature of this nation. That was part of the visceral feeling that people had, why people voted for Barack in such huge numbers, you know, across the board in 2008, you know. And I think That and the struggle didn't stop when he was there. Black Lives Matter didn't stop. People were organizing communities. There were all kinds of stuff going on. People didn't stop. I mean, when I first saw Barack Obama get up there and become president, I mean, my first reaction was, uh-oh, what's happening here? His economic advisors all come from Wall Street. My first thing I looked at was that. Then all of a sudden I looked at most of his advisors around him were white men. And I went, what? We're all the other voices inside this group to talk about where we're going, right? Mm-hmm. He could have had an executive action that said, I'm stopping all mortgages in America until we get this mess straight. And we're going to push that, and then we're going to kind of reinstitute Glass-Steagall or something similar to push the ban. He couldn't do that. I mean, maybe because he was being attacked. And he was going to let single payer into the debate. Single payer couldn't even get into the debate about what the future of health care was going to be in America. It wasn't even in the debate. So that's what I'm saying. It was a really, I think, his election and his presidency at the heart of it all explained the complexity of race and class in this country.
And it's also a question of where power resides. Because ultimately, the fact, like those dynamics you just laid out, to me, illustrates a very, it's demonstrative of how this country is constructed and how power really works. Power doesn't work when you get elected to an office and then you can bring the people you want in with you. I think ultimately, when people look at electoral politics, they see it as a panacea of all political action, when it's just really one tool. Like electing Barack Obama, we should have been organized at the grassroots level to hold the Democratic Party accountable for what Barack Obama was doing. The problem is that when he got elected, we just ceded all of our influence and power to the Democratic Party, and then we got upset when Hillary Clinton didn't get elected president, when in fact, we didn't spend any time organizing during that 8 years. So when she became the candidate, there was no reason for her to speak to our conditions, to speak to our issues, and there was no reason for them to lift up a candidate who could directly speak to what was going on with black folks. So it just speaks to how power works in this country.
Mm-hmm. So Sarah, let me let you jump before we go to Adar, because okay. I know you have to leave soon, then we'll come mm-hmm. right back to Adar. Mm-hmm. Sarah?
Yeah, I don't know if I agree that we weren't organizing during that time. There were enormous low-wage worker struggles. There was Black Lives Matter came along. I think there was some really extraordinary organizing that was happening at the grassroots. But I think the Democratic Party decided that they could take us for granted. They decided that they could force Bernie Sanders out of the race by various different mechanisms that came out during those leaks, and that they could then insist on a candidate who was friendly to Wall Street, and that we would all have to just bow down and take it because we didn't have anywhere to go. And I think that was a huge mistake. I think it was, you know, because a lot of people just stayed home and people voted for third candidates. And a certain number of those folks who had been Bernie Sanders supporters actually voted for Donald Trump because they were so tired of that kind of insider manipulation of the electoral system. I think that was a huge mistake, but I think a certain number of people did do that. So I think the organizing continued, but the Democratic Party, you know, I remember right after Obama's whole, remember you had that Camp Obama, you had all those young people fired up and going out and campaigning, and I remember thinking, okay, now we've got a movement as well as a president. But the Democratic Party took a hold of all of that campaign infrastructure, and instead of using it to get people activated and to get them talking about health care and to becoming a really political force that could have overcome all that opposition to things like the public option in the health care plan, they just sat on it, used it for fundraising, and used it to try to do their top-down, you know, do it our way kind of messaging. So I think we've got to do any organizing we do from now on, we've got to keep an independent infrastructure so the Democratic Party can't grab it and then use it for their own neoliberal ends.
I think that's the hard lesson that we're learning about this idea of learning how to organize outside of this two-party system, trying to resist being pushed back into that system, ceding all our power like we did, you know, with Jesse Jackson, ceding all our power like we did with Barack Obama, really making the effort to push this system to open up so that other candidates who are running will have a voice and will be able to get that spot on the podium, whether or not the Democrats and the Republicans will let them get there. I think this was a very hard wake-up call for people. People who've been sitting on the sidelines, who've been waiting for answers to come to them, who were expecting Barack Obama to save them and then critiqued him when he didn't. This is a hard wake-up call that if you actually want change to come in this country, you have to be willing to do the hard work on the local level and then push it up to make and hold people accountable for the decisions that they're making. Have you called your senator? Have you written a letter? Have you gotten involved with local politics? You can't expect D.C. to ever change the machine that's been running this country in terms of power and how power concedes nothing without a demand unless you're willing to do the work on a local level and push the energy upwards so we can force them to do something different.
And to Barack Obama's credit, that was one thing that he emphasized, that, you know, people needed to push him to get things done. And I think that in that way, he did have an understanding of how not only power, but economic power works. Because the reason that we have a two-party system is because so many third-party candidates do not have the economic juice and are not backed, right, and do not have access to whatever funds are out there so that they can mount a campaign which is completely dependent on the amount of money that you have, and especially when it's a national campaign. So there is that, and I'm going to push back on you a little, and this is like an old argument between the two of us.
That's fine. I don't mind that at all.
You know, no, I enjoy it too. So when we talk about Barack Obama, we have to talk about the optics, not only in terms of him, not, you know, being a black man ascending to the presidency,
right.
Not only in terms of his story, but also, Mark, in terms of the thing that you brought up, which is the people with whom he surrounded himself during his campaign. And because those people were white and a lot of them moneyed, even though he had a lot of grassroots support too, he had enough to make different constituencies comfortable. And we can't ever forget that in talking about this, right? And also the way that he talked about race, you know, was different. And he did what every presidential candidate has done in modern history, was that he went to black communities and lectured black communities about the so-called failings of black culture. He did that during 2008 and 2012. So the signals that he gave in terms of his conversation also made white America comfortable. Now, I don't think that it is an either or. I think that it can be a lot of different things at the same time. And I do think that that is what was operating. In terms of Hillary Clinton, we can talk about wrong message. We can talk about monies. We can talk about everything. But we also have to talk about misogyny.
Oh, yes.
We also
right.
have
Absolutely.
To talk about the right. fact that for the past 20 years or 30 years, it seems like she's been on the scene forever.
But she's been a long time.
That we have to talk about her as being ground zero in the societal culture wars in terms of the changing role of women. Right. Ever since she made the comment, I'm not just going to make cookies and stand by my man like Tammy Wynette. Folk have hated, yeah, although she ended up doing that, folk have hated Hillary Clinton. So there's all of that, too. And we're not talking about that. The other thing that we're not talking about is, regardless of the quote unquote wrong message, you know, whatever, girlfriend still won the popular vote by
yes,
a couple
did.
Of million.
Almost 3 million.
Almost
yes,
3 million. So let's not forget that. That message, for however wrong or incomplete it was, resonated with a greater part of the population than Donald Trump's did.
And I think that's really real. I mean, that's why we're in such a weird place in this
it's
country right
now. It's a very weird place.
You know, I mean, you know, Sarah, I mean, it's just like, you know, when you think about that, almost 3 million votes more than Donald Trump. We have this Electoral College, which really is a vestige of slavery. Right?
Absolutely.
That people didn't pay attention to, that now they are paying
exactly.
attention to.
That was created to ensure that the Southern states held the majority in the U.S. Congress.
Kept that vote.
And that was where it came from. You read the debate between, is it Charles Wilson, Jonathan Wilson from Pennsylvania, and James Madison. They had this ferocious debate as they were writing the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. Ferocious debate. And the debate was Wilson saying, no, you shouldn't get... The South came in saying, we want 5/5, a whole person, to be in an electoral college for every person we have enslaved.
Yep.
Right? And they whittled them down to 3/5.
Mm-hmm. They wanted the whole four.
They wanted the whole thing.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
But that was the debate they had. I mean, so that vestige, mm-hmm. in many ways, is what gave us Mr. Trump.
Exactly.
But people were not looking at that. I think the interesting thing about what happened, what gave us Mr. Trump, is that people started really examining the Electoral College. I can't understand why people didn't examine it after Bush v. Gore. We had this same kind of discussion with this idea. I mean, I know you did on the Steiner Show, and many other camps talked about the Electoral College with
right.
Bush v. Gore. But we passed the power, you know, we passed it on, people accepted it, they got complacent, and then when it came up again, it's like, why do we still have this system? I'm like, it's the same discussion of how power always controls the narrative. It is an old system of power. It's still in place, and it needs to be torn down. It won't be torn down in time for us to have a new president by 2017.
But if you're talking about power, I mean, again, it's the question of how power works, and it's who is in power, for what ends, and what institutions are the ones that control these levers of power. And ultimately, that points back to racism and white supremacy. If we're talking about the people that control this country, operate it, and the reason that the Electoral College hasn't been changed isn't just because, you know, there's heated debate. It's because there are people that want to make, that are insured, institutions that are insured, that never transforms itself. And so the question is, how do we actually change something like the Electoral College? And to me, I mean, I don't have any faith in federal politics. I think that we should be focusing, instead of the Electoral College, there's local issues and local candidates you can run to take control of cities. I never forget Maxine Waters gave a speech about how, you know, the hip hop generation, how we have all these numbers of black people who are like millennials now, I guess you call them, but who can vote in large numbers. And we have whole voting blocks in cities like Baltimore. We should just take cities. I never forget that. And ever since then, I was thinking, why am I focused so much on who's running for president when all we can do is take the mayor, the city council, and control cities and control resources as opposed to focusing on the president?
So before we go to break, Sarah, I know you have to run after this break, so I wanted to let you jump in and kind of take us to break.
Great. Thank you, Mark. Yeah, I totally agree with you on the local. I just think we have so much more power locally than we think we do. And that was the conclusion I came to after traveling around the country for 4 months in a little camper, stopping all over the country, everywhere from Indian reservations to Rust Belt cities to Appalachia, asking questions about how people are changing their circumstances. And I came away feeling that people have a lot more power to do that than they realize. So yes to local power. I'm totally on board with that. And the other thing I want to say about this disparity between what Hillary Clinton got in the way of a popular vote is that we need to keep pushing back against anything that sounds like a mandate. We just need to be so clear that there is absolutely no mandate for any of these horrible policies that Donald Trump keeps pushing out through the people he's appointed, through the kinds of policies that they're talking about. These are disastrous policies, everything from the education secretary on down. So, you know, let's just keep on with that, and also echoing what Representative Lewis said, there's not only no mandate, there's really no legitimacy, because the evidence is pretty clear that there's probably no way that Trump could have won with such incredibly low approval ratings without the help of the Russians. So to have a guy taking power right now who won because a foreign government interceded on his behalf not only questions his mandate, it questions his very legitimacy. And I just think we've got to keep on hammering on that question at the same time as we're building power locally through organizing, we're building power locally through what we choose to do, just like Adam was saying just a minute ago. And so, thank you so much for having me on, Mark. I really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad you were with us. And Sarah Van Gelder, who has written the book The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through New America, will be at Politics and Prose on February the 1st with me, and then again here in Baltimore February 2nd at Red Emma's with her book. So I'm glad you could join us for this time. And we're going to take a short break and come back with Adam Jackson, Kay Whitehead, Adara Yair to conclude our conversation. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Mark.
We'll be coming back right after this news break. Don't go away. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com. Welcome back, folks. This is Mark Steiner right here on The Mark Steiner Show on WEAA 88.9 FM, home of the big 4-0 birthday bash taking place Saturday, January 28th at the Motor House. It's going to be a tremendous evening, so please join us. More information at WEAA.org. We want you to come party with us here at WEAA. Because after what we're doing today, we're going to need a party. So we are here in the studio with Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle, Dr. Carsonia K. Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication and African and African American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland, author of Race Brave, New and Selected Works, Notes from a Color Girl's Color Girl, The Civil War Pocket Diaries of Emily Frances Davis, and My Black Sons Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America, and Adara Ayira, who is Project Manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities, and facilitator and analyst at Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. So, picking up on this moment we're in, and really talk a bit about what's happening as we're speaking here today, this inauguration. And I, you know, I am one of those who was really kind of shocked when I saw it coming through, but I didn't think about the Electoral College and the role it will play in this election. But it's interesting that, you know, we have all these Maryland congressmen. Two of our 8 congressmen are not taking part in the inauguration today. Elijah Cummings tweeted out that he was going to go, and he was wrestling with that. But the newly elected Jamie Raskin from Montgomery County and Anthony Brown from Prince George's County are not attending, among 66 other congressional representatives who are not going, or whatever that number is. It keeps growing. This sense to me, I think we're really, it feels as if people in the opposition here are not going to sit down and take this lightly. The fact that, I mean, it's unprecedented. I mean, well, when Barack Obama was first elected and again elected, re-elected in 2012, a lot of Republicans left town. People forget that.
Right. Oh, Bush 1 and 2 didn't come. Yeah.
Bonner left. All the Speaker of the House, Bonner left. All the other guys left. They left. A lot of them left town. So we forget that. People don't talk about that. But having them, but people not just not showing up, but openly saying, I will not attend. I'm not going to be part of this. I mean, that's pretty stunning.
You know, and I think that people really have to think about their own conscience and think about what is the right thing to do in this situation. And as I see the list growing longer, especially among the Congressional Black Caucus and others, this phrase continues to come to my mind, which is, I will not collude in my own oppression. So we talk about that the most important thing is a peaceful transfer of power, as if that is the thing that we should hold up and put that even higher than people's lives, and put that even higher than the concerns that this country is moving backwards, not for everyone, but for certain groups of people that have always been marginalized. And I think that in framing this as, oh, these people are not going to be at the inauguration, that it really is missing the larger issue and the larger message of how frightened people are, of how resistant people are, and the fact that people are going to continue to fight.
I mean, I guess in terms of them not going to the inauguration, I don't know. Those types of symbolic actions to me, at the end of the day, like, who are you actually with? Because it's like, you're going to protest by not going to Donald Trump's inauguration. You're going to probably talk in the news media over the next several months about how awful he is. But where is the actual come to Jesus moment where we actually transform politics in this country? Because I know the day after inauguration, tomorrow, the first thing that the Democratic Party is going to try to figure out is, how do we attract all these people we've lost after this election? And they're going to try to integrate us back into the same burning building of the Democratic Party and the two-party system, and nothing is going to be transformed in this country. And so we're talking about Donald Trump and what's going to happen during his presidency and the actions people are taking. The action we should be taking is building power in our communities, not focusing on the election. Because I get it, Elijah Cummings and Anthony Brown and folks like them have to care about that because they're in elected office on the federal level. I don't, because I live in Baltimore. It doesn't matter who's president. I saw a meme the other day that had different pictures of, like, the same neighborhood. It all looked the same. It's like after Bush, after Clinton, after Obama, same thing. So to people in Gilmore Homes, they don't care. They don't care if it was Trump or Clinton. In their mind, they're the same person. And so symbolic gestures of, yeah, I will protest this president, cool. Well, also confront your party on why they're not responding to transforming the conditions of black people in this country. Because to me, that's more substantive than protesting and saying, we're not going to go to the inauguration. No one cares. I don't care. And they shouldn't care. So they should be figuring out tomorrow, the next day, what are we actually going to do to transform people's lives? Not instead of just taking these symbolic, empty gestures that don't mean anything when you look at the election and how they're political careers have panned out over the past 10, 20 years.
It's a symbolic gesture that they're jumping on this bandwagon that's already moving. I'm trying to figure out what took them so long to get here, that you've been wrestling with. If you read the statements that they're making through Twitter, I've been wrestling with it. It's been heavy on my heart. Like, wait, where have you been for the last couple of weeks? Right. We've been talking about what these issues are. You're just getting here. John Lewis has done it. Now here you come making your big Twitter statement that you're also not doing. You're getting your 5 minutes of press about making this decision. Mm-hmm. You can protest the inauguration today. You don't have to go, but you got to show up to work on Monday, because we need people to be there to really show us by your actions, mm-hmm. not by your deeds, by not going today, mm-hmm. by your actions of being able to put policies in place to block whatever he has planned and what the Republican Party has planned.
Well, let's hope that as they boycott, they're all going in a room someplace to figure out what they're going to do.
They're
playing their position. they're playing their position. And their position, for whatever reason, whether it is resisting oppression, whether it is because they want to have their Twitter moment or whatever, they're playing their position. We have to play our positions, you know, and our positions in this next 4 years and beyond is local, and it is exploring how we stay off of a 21st century political plantation that is either Republican or Democrat. That's the position that we should be playing.
Well, that should have been the position.
It should have been the position.
Instead of staying off, we need to get off, because currently we have been on it for a very long time. We need to get off the plantation. We need to put some policies in place. What does that look like? For people on the local level, that should look different. I think that people also need to push these leaders to hold them accountable. I've been saying the same thing, that many of the people who've come forward and they've made their, you know, their come to Jesus moment. Oh, I'm not going to go today. I didn't go. I didn't participate. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until people began calling their office and putting things out on Twitter saying, why is my senator going? Why is my representative going? That's letting people know you have power to hold them accountable.
But and so let me, as I like to play here, this game, let me push a little harder here on this. I mean, from another perspective. I think that when you look at the reasoning, like when you read Representative Maxine Waters, Congresswoman Waters, I never ever contemplated attending the inauguration or any activities associated with Donald Trump. I wouldn't waste my time. But there's a lot of that. And I think that, you know, look, I agree that the organizing has to happen inside our cities and communities. That's where the power takes place, from the bottom up, and it has to be pushed out, and it has to happen here in Baltimore and across the country, people's localities. I mean, that is where it is, because we can see without power what happens. We have these newly elected city council people. Hopefully they will keep people's feet to the fire and not lose who they say they are. And we have to keep pushing them so they don't. Mm-hmm. We saw what happened with Port Covington and how the people lost out in that battle around Port Covington and more. But these congressional representatives, these 60-odd people, I don't know the exact number now, 66, I think, though we have to organize locally, this is still the United States, and there's still a Congress that makes these laws, and there's still a national voice that has to be heard in this fight. I don't put these people down because they just did it. I mean, they're taking a stand. They're not going. They're having meetings in their churches and their community. They're going back home to fight against and stay home and really go to their churches and synagogues and mosques and say, this is what we're doing, Ralph Ellison in his mosque and other people in their churches. I mean, so I think this is a positive step. I mean, you know, you talk about third parties. Mm-hmm. Let's throw this out here just a minute. I mean, we had talked about this the other day on the show on Wednesday with Lester Spence and Arun Gupta. And one of the things we posited there was that third parties don't just happen. Mm-hmm. They happen because a disruption happens, because something explodes internally inside a party that's also being pushed from the outside. Right? And if there's going to be a viable third party, a lot of these folks who didn't go to the inauguration are going to be in that third party.
Well, that's the thing. This is all political theatrics, because to me, at the end of every election...
But don't you need theatrics sometimes? Theater is part of it.
Yeah, but the thing is, on a national level, like, none of that is helping anybody change the conditions that they live in every day. That's the fundamental issue, because people talk, even after George Bush was first elected president in his first term, people were talking about how much we need to change, you know, he has control over, but it's like every year it's the same cyclical conversation about, well, maybe these people will get involved. But to me, it's like the material effect you should have, like people who are congressmen, like people like Anthony Brown, how much money is he going to bring from the federal government to PG County?
Mm-hmm.
Like, how much money? Like, that, to me, that's a material impact. I don't care about his stance on Trump. I care about poor and working class black people in PG County. I care about poor and working class black people in Baltimore. I don't care about their position towards Trump, because in my mind, he's not going to have an impact on anything that we do on a daily basis. Now, there's stuff like the consent decree that matters, that, you know, since he's appointing the attorney general, that matters. But in the grand scheme of things, when we're looking at systemic change in Baltimore, it's us. It's us that live here that have the control. So the theatrics of who's going to be siding with Trump is just really people trying to put their name in the media, trying to get themselves more access to their progressive friends. Like, that's a bunch of games, and I don't got time to play games. If it's about people's lives, then we got to start at home, not in D.C. talking about Trump. That's all symbolic.
So all of those things can happen at the same time.
It
is not, it's not an either or. It is, where do you want to work and where can you most effectively work? I mean, that's the question. And I hear you very clearly, Adam, that, you know, where you are working is local, right? And I think that all of us work local, and that doesn't mean that it's the only work that we do, but it does mean that it is work that we view as critical and that we view as important. My question would be, what are they doing after?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, today, are they actually organizing within themselves, having meetings that we don't know about?
Right.
Because if you're trumpeting your strategy to the world, well, forget it. You know, but what are you really doing, that, and how are you going to show up tomorrow? And how are you going to show up Monday? And how are you going to continue to show up during these 4 years in your role? That's the most important thing. Today is a start, and it is an optic, it is a visual, but what happens beyond that? And that's the question. And let me just say this to you before I shut up. Trump is not the problem. Right. The people who voted for Trump is the problem. Now, I understand that Trump is now our policy problem. But I'm saying that Trump would not be where he was were it not for the America that voted Trump in, knowing fully who he was. Nobody can say that he fooled them. He was as he is showing up now. And people like that, and people, for whatever reason, were ready to throw the rest of America, Muslims, immigrants, people of color, transgender, whatever, they were willing to throw those people, those groups of people, under the bus for whatever reason. That is the problem.
Well, in addressing that problem and recognizing what we have to do to be present in this moment, it is about the organizing. We have to be clear about the America that we live in. I think that this notion of this wake-up call that I just keep thinking about, particularly today as we are inaugurating our 45th president, this wake-up call that there is an America that has been running alongside this notion of the post-racial America that people may not have been paying attention to. These are the people that you may have campaigned with, you may have had coffee with, who said one thing on the microphone and then went into the booths by themselves and made another decision, the decision that was closest to their heart. So when we talk about holding our officials accountable, okay, so we started today. These optics of, oh, I'm not going to support. I don't want my local representatives to support. I want to hear that you are verbally and vocally saying you do not support what is happening. I also then need to remind you, as many times as it will take, to have you then show me in policy, show me in your work that you don't support this. I don't think that the only problem, as you said, is just the people who voted for Trump. I think about the fact that the executive branch is now controlled by a Republican. I think about the fact that the legislative branch is now controlled primarily by Republicans. I think about the fact that when and if Donald Trump puts a conservative into the Supreme Court, we're talking about a
balance of power. All of that goes back to the vote.
There will be a mandate of kind of one single voice coming. People should be concerned about that. When we talk about pushing our officials, thinking about what these policies mean as they trickle down and how it's really going to, as you said, Adam, that you look at, you know, the neighborhoods after Bush, after Clinton, after Gore, after Obama, what are they going to look like after Trump? And can we start today to continue to disrupt that narrative?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, to me, very complex on a bunch of different levels here. I mean, there are two things, and I completely agree about the racist push in this, and you've got Steve Bannon, Jeff Sessions, Michael Flynn, I mean, avowed racists who are now surrounding Donald Trump in very major important positions in this country that will affect people of color, Muslim Americans, African Americans, lots
immigrants.
Of people.
For generations.
Yes.
It could be for generations.
Yeah. Supreme Court it
could be.
Picks.
It could be 100 years.
So
and
that's and that, you know. And then the other part, though, is the Democrats, because they're so tied into Wall Street themselves, are part of the problem.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, let me give you a little story here and let's see what you make of this. So I think I have the union right. I think it's the Sheet Metal Workers Union in Washington, Prince George's County and Montgomery County. They have like 160 members, I think. Something, they're not a huge union. Racially mixed, but not a huge union. That union, for almost to a person, voted for Trump. They voted for Trump, they say, because the Affordable Care Act, one of the clauses in there, says that if you are a Cadillac health program that really covers everything, you have to pay a certain fine to the system. So their small union, their local, had to pay $600,000 to keep their health insurance alive for their members. So they said, ACA is baloney. Democrats don't care about us. We're going to vote for Trump and do something different. That's why I'm saying when I say it's complex.
Yeah, it is.
You know, I mean, because the Democrats did not answer. That's part. People were upset. They didn't answer the they didn't answer their needs as well. You know, so and I think that, but I think that's awesome. So that's real. But the undertone is deeply real.
Well, right. So it's the complexity of racism.
Because, exactly.
Right.
Because
exactly.
The Democratic Party not being able to see that kind of dynamic as impairing people's lives is also the problem.
Right.
Which to me is endemic of why the United States it itself is rooted in white supremacy and racism. So being able to approach it not as it's the Republican Party, it's Donald Trump.
Right.
It's a writ large problem with this country. And if the Democratic Party plans to have anybody in office in the next 4 years or 8 years, then those are the kinds of things it has to address. But ultimately, I have no faith in their ability to do that. That's where
I'm
at.
Surprised.
Yeah, have zero faith in their ability to do that. That's why, to me, the organizing locally for power is more important, because that's stuff that we can control and sustain. The Democratic Party can do the same exact thing in 8 more years. That's like they took us for granted when we voted for Obama. They do the same exact thing when we vote for somebody else in 4 years. And it could be another candidate who's actually great, but ultimately they're going to take advantage of us. They're going to just vote for what they want, and then they're not going to respond to our needs. So to me, the most sustainable solution is the local base building that's necessary to have power that is separate of the Democratic Party, because it shows the systemic racism is infecting both areas of our political system.
And whether we're doing local organizing, whether we are talking about third party, whether we are talking about a national party, whatever we're talking about, the critical nature of doing the work and having politicians and policymakers that have a deep understanding of a racial equity lens. Mm-hmm. Because it doesn't matter what type of work we're doing, if we are coming from the same base of where we have always been in terms of the lens which we're using.
But also
we need an equity lens.
But we also need to think about this idea of having a critical class lens as well. That is also something that gets
It's intersectional.
Yes, but when you start talking about using the example that Mark Steiner gave us in the beginning, it's not taken into account the class issue as well. Yes, we have systemic racism. We also have this deep-rooted sense of classism in this country that the Democratic Party does not address that as well. When they think about white supremacy and they think about the issues that people are involved in, they forget that there is a base of people in this country that are not black, but who are dealing with some very serious economic deep divides and looked for an answer to what they felt would help them better their lives. That was not addressed.
They were willing to throw under the bus. Now, let's be real. In this country, class operates within the context of race. And that's why when we talk about poverty, there's a difference between poverty if you're a person of color, poverty if you are white, and the potential of your rising above that. It's hard for everybody, but it is even harder if you're a person of color. Yes.
Absolutely.
I thought you were going to fight me. You're not going to fight me, Kate.
Well,
okay, good.
Race, class, and gender are deeply
exactly
connected.
And that's why I'm saying that there's got to be intersectional, an intersectional lens. And if we're talking about an equity lens, we are talking about intersectionality. We cannot do policy without that lens.
But then I think it gets more even more complex than that in my book. And I think that's where class and race are in a dialectical dance with one another. Complete dialectical dance with one another. I mean, ultimately, it also depends on what kind of system you want to see America be. If you want to see a capitalist system survive in America and grow, and that is the system you think we should have, and you are black and you are on Wall Street, your interest is going to be with that capitalist system and not with the people who live in Gilmore Homes. That's real, too.
But it's all, I mean, I think and to Adar's point, it's all rooted in racism and white supremacy. That's where it
right.
emanates
but
from.
You, because right, we but, talk about capitalism. We don't talk about racial capitalism, which is the system that we are operating out of. We don't call it that.
No, because
we operate.
Without slavery, there would have been no capitalism.
Right,
so capitalism itself
together.
Is based.
Right. Exactly.
They wouldn't have existed.
Exactly.
And that's why the economy of America was based on enslaving people. By 1865,
half
the economy of America.
And now we're doing it by a new name, as Michelle Alexander said. So we call it capitalism as if race doesn't have anything to do with that. And we have to acknowledge that even today, race is rooted in how we operationalize a capitalist system. And we don't acknowledge that at all, not in our policies, not even in our conversation.
But there's so much research about that. I mean, you were wondering if I was going to fight you on intersectionality. I'm not sure how anyone who looks at this system, who looks and understands the ways in which race and class and gender are all connected, can have a fight about intersectionality. It was trying to look at the example that Steiner had put forth talking about that particular thing. Yes, I agree. Intersectionality is the only way to approach it, not just from Michelle Alexander and New Jim Crow, but really looking at, you know, Kimberly Crenshaw's work to have people understand what does it mean to take an intersectional lens to look at all these issues and see how they're all deeply rooted in racism. And that's what builds and sustains this system of the class divide. I mean, there's great pieces out here. I think just immediately of Ta-Nehisi Coates' last piece on me, my president was black. That notion of if you are white, a white family, you're making $100,000, and you are a black family, you're making $100,000, you are living in two different class levels that you're so far removed. Even though you're bringing the same dollar amount into the household, you are in two different Americas because of this issue from race. You can't even compare the white middle class to the black middle class because you don't bring into this account of what it means to be black in America does affect what your class system is, and the predatory nature that black people have to deal with when it comes to getting loans, getting student loans, getting housing loans. So you cannot look at it without using an intersectional
lens. That's why I say that the class operates within a context of race. And saying that does not negate class issues. It doesn't negate it. It just acknowledges the complexity as well as the DNA root of racism that still is in this country and in everything in this country. It helps to explain it.
Well, it explains why you can have movements on the left that are kind of, we didn't get into the one piece I wanted to get into today, which maybe we'll do again and reprise this.
Yes, we have to.
Which is when I look at where we are today, I think in many ways of a couple of different historical periods. I think of an understanding of history. I think of Germany in 1932, Adolf Hitler won with 32% of the vote. The liberals, social democrats, socialists, communists were so busy fighting each other that they didn't stop the fascists from coming in and beginning their extermination and whatever else they did in Europe of 11 million people in camps and more, right? It's also 1877 when Rutherford B. Hayes was ushered into office with less than the popular vote, killed Reconstruction, and began the 10-12-year march to legalize segregation through the terror on the black communities in the South.
People were not paying attention to it.
And we have to figure out where we are. And my fear is in America, we're going to remain so divided here on lots of different levels that we're not going to be able to confront what could be coming, could be coming down the pike in the next 8 years.
You know, another thing we have not paid attention to, and I'm
you
raising
have the
this.
Last thought
oh, okay, then let me
left.
Make a quit. Ah. I'm raising this because the assassination of the anniversary of the assassination of Patrice Lumumba.
Yes.
So we are losing our minds over Russia interfering in our election, but we do not give one thought of contemplation to how we have done the same
the
in
world.
So many different countries
our
all
Benz
over the
in
world.
Guatemala, Patrice Lumumba in the Congo.
Right. We're still,
and are still
helping
doing it.
The navigate policy in other countries, and then we get concerned about them doing it here.
We will pick this up. So as we speak, someone's becoming 45th president of the United States, and I want to thank my guests for being here. This has been a great conversation. Sarah Van Gelder joined us earlier, who was executive editor and co-founder of Yes Magazine. Her book, The Revolution Where You Live, Stories from a 12,000-Mile Journey Through a New America. Adam Jackson, CEO of Leaders for a Beautiful Struggle. Dr. Carsonia K. Whitehead, Associate Professor of Communication, African-American Studies at Loyola University, Maryland. Author of numerous books, including Race Brave, New and Selected Works, and My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. And Adar Ayira, Project Manager of More in the Middle Campaign for Associated Black Charities and Facilitator and analyst at the Baltimore Racial Justice Action, a program of fusion partnerships. Thank all of you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Anytime.
Appreciate it.
So now for the last half hour of the Mark Steiner Show, we are bringing you a brand new episode of The Rise of Charm City. The women putting this out do remarkable work. You'll enjoy this like you've enjoyed all their other work. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our senior producer is Mark Gunnery. Our producer is Imani Spence. Our research producer is Calvin Perry. Our production assistant is Nadia Ramlagan. Our engineer is Andre Melton. Our theme music is by Warren Matthews with Clean Cuts. And send me your thoughts about today's program to talk@steinershow.org. To podcast the Mark Steiner Show and share it with your friends, visit us on the web at steinershow.org or listen to us via your favorite podcasting app. And for your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, home of the Big 4-0 Birthday Bash, taking place Saturday, January 28th. More info at weaa.org. I'm Mark Steiner. Have a wonderful weekend. Take care.